One of the things I remember from being a teenager was I remember at one point, me and a friend of mine, we decided we would start doing some research. You know, we had part-time jobs. How much would it actually cost us to just set up an apartment on our own, to just get out of having to live in our parents' place? Started doing research on what it would cost to set things up and eat, and needless to say, we didn't move out on our own. But we had this sense of that if we could just get out on our own, then we wouldn't have to worry about all these things, all these responsibilities that our parents were putting on us. We would be free from all of that. You know, we wouldn't have to have all of these obligations. And anybody ever having a sense of feeling like that? Now, how many people, when they moved out on their own, discovered a life free of responsibility and full of... No one, really? Sometimes the idea that if I can just leave this thing behind, then I'll be totally free and everything will be great, doesn't end up the way we want it to be. And sometimes we end up outside of that place where we felt like we were stuck and even longing for being back to where we were. The story we're going to look at today as we begin our season of Lent, it looks at the story of the people of Israel. It looks at the story of what it looks like for them to live in the wilderness. Now, in their case, they were supposed to leave the old behind. And we're going to kind of look through and try and see ourselves in their story. And as we do that, I want us to consider, first of all, we to a certain extent do live in their kind of story. The story of Israel talks about them being slaves. They're being stuck in this place where they don't have freedom. They can't worship the way they want. They're being oppressed. And when they finally get the freedom, it's freedom that they wanted, and freedom into this new life of what it means to be this nation outside of the thumb of slavery. You know, we have this verse of the year that we rehearse every once in a while. It talks about us being a new creation in Christ. Other passages talk about us getting this freedom from the slavery of sin and into this new life that we need to discover what it means to live like and to live in. And so as we reflect on Israel's story, there is a huge parallel to our story. It's not slavery under a nation, it's slavery under sin. It's not freedom to try and be this new national people together. It's freedom to be followers of Jesus in this new family together. And there's a bit of a journey involved, because while we already have this taste of this new thing that God has in store for us, we aren't all the way to the place that He's promised we will get to yet. We're living in this time that theologians call the already. We're already free, but we're not yet fully there. Already not yet time. And so there's a lot in the story of Israel that we can kind of relate to when we think about our experience as people of God in this world. So let's just think about Israel's story for a little bit. If you want to open to the book of Exodus, I'm kind of going to be tracking quickly, just rehearsing the early stages of the story while we look into a couple of specific things this morning. Now, who remembers how and why Israel ended up in Egypt in the first place? There we go. One word answer. Joseph got sold into slavery, ended up in Egypt, ended up becoming one of the power people in Egypt who prepared them to be able to not have to suffer through a famine that impacted all the area around it. Famine is just when they don't have enough food to eat. Sometimes economic reasons, but usually drought is involved as well. And so they have this huge famine, and Joseph, who was one of Jacob or Israel's sons, ends up in slavery in Egypt. And then when his brothers come to buy some food from the Egyptians, then he discovers, he recognizes who they are, and a series of events leads them to come under his protection and live in the land of Egypt. And they raise up, there's 12 of them, they start having all kinds of kids and grandkids, and they grow. And eventually, the Egyptian pharaoh says, I'm a little bit worried about this whole nation of people that are starting to grow in the midst of us. We're worried that they might start taking us over. So they decide to subject them to slavery. and they make Israel slaves. And they are slaves for generations. It's hard to know exactly how many years. It depends on what you're reading and how you're interpreting some different numbers in the Bible. But they were slaves for a number of generations. And it's getting worse and worse. And God hears their cry for freedom, and he raises up Moses. And we know the story. Many of us, most of us, I hope, know the story of Moses as they decide to prevent the nation of Israel from getting stronger. The Egyptians decide they're going to kill all of the young boys. And so Moses is one of the young boys that's born, and his mom puts him in this basket she's made and puts him out in the Nile River and to try and keep him safe until he's old enough. And while he's out there, the Pharaoh's daughter finds him, and she adopts him. And really cool story about how she adopts him, and Moses' older sister goes and says, "Hey, I know somebody who can maybe take care of him for you and could kind of be his nanny if you want." And the Pharaoh's daughter says, "Sure, go ahead." And so his mother ends up raising him as a support person for Pharaoh's daughter. But Moses gets adopted into Pharaoh's family and grows up as a prince in Egypt. But knowing all the while that he is a Hebrew. And so he starts to struggle with this identity. And when he's seeing the poor treatment of his people, he sees one particularly horrible incident. And in kind of a fit of rage, he responds killing an Egyptian. And in fear, he runs off into the desert, into his own kind of time of exile. And Moses is called by God as a leader while he's out in exile. And he comes back. And he has to convince the nation of Israel he is sent by God, and he is there to help them. And then there's a whole series of plagues, and God raises things. He turns the situation so that Pharaoh decides he's going to let Israel go out into the wilderness. And then when you get to Exodus 13, they've run into the wilderness following Moses and Aaron. There's a pillar of God. It actually says in verse 21, "By day, the Lord went ahead of them in a pillar of cloud to guide them on their way, and by night in a pillar of fire to give them light, so that they could travel by night. Neither the pillar of cloud by day nor the pillar of fire by night left its place in front of the people." So literally, it's not Moses and Aaron, it is God in this pillar leading them out. So God led them out of Egypt in this miraculous way. They've watched all of the plagues that have happened. They've seen God at work. And it doesn't take very long before they start to complain. In Exodus 14, the first complaint is about danger. The first complaint comes because they have been led out and they find themselves at the edge of the Red Sea. And so they're looking in front of them, seeing there's water they can't pass, and they look back, and Pharaoh's decided to change his mind. And so Pharaoh's army is now starting to come out of Egypt, and they can see this cloud coming in the distance as they are coming to get them, and they start to complain. In verse 10, "As Pharaoh approached, the Israelites looked up, and there were the Egyptians marching after them. They were terrified and cried out to the Lord. They said to Moses, 'Was it because there were no graves in Egypt that you brought us to the desert to die? What have we done? What have you done to us by bringing us out of Egypt? Didn't we say to you in Egypt, leave us alone, but let us serve the Egyptians? It would have been better for us to serve the Egyptians than die in the desert.'" And they start complaining. Even after all they've seen God do, they get in this moment and they say, "Why did you bring us here?" Well, what happens? Red Sea parts, they walk across, and as Pharaoh's army comes in, the sea comes back down, and God delivers them again. So surely now, they will be able to trust. And then you get to Exodus 15, the next chapter. And then chapter starts with this great song that Moses and Israel sings, and then Miriam sings this great song about God's delivering them. The song ends at verse 21, and at verse 24, they're complaining again. I know this is how the story is told, but they get out there from the Dead Sea, and they travel the desert, and they can't find water. They come to this place called Marah where the water is bitter so they can't drink it. And so they complain, what are we supposed to drink? They're already complaining. And God uses this mundane piece of wood that gets thrown into the water to help it not be bitter. And God provides for them again. You know what? Okay, so safety was an issue. I'll provide you deliverance from that danger. Water is an issue. I'm going to give you some water to drink. And after he gives them this fresh water, it actually says he takes them to a place where there's 12 springs and palm trees. He brings them to this oasis where they can just enjoy their freedom for a while. And then they set out on another journey through the desert to get to the land that God's promised for them. And after God's provided for them, and after God has helped them get enjoy that time by the springs, we move into chapter 16, and by chapter 16, verse 3, they are complaining again. They get out there, and they're running out of food. They don't know what they're going to eat. And instead of, what's fascinating, it's not that they're asking for food. That's not what's going on. Let me put it this way. If you were a parent and your child came with this type of request for food, how would you feel? If only we had died by the Lord's hand in Egypt. There we sat around eating pots of meat and ate all the food we wanted. But you brought us out into this desert to starve this entire assembly to death. It's not a request for food. It's complaining. It's this lament. And God's response to it again is to provide food. We read it in the story that we read together where he gives them quail, he gives them meat, he gives them bread. He even, in the process of giving them that, gives them a day of rest when they don't even have to go out and collect their food. Time and time again, they're grumbling at the danger and God frees them. They grumble at needing water and he gives them something to drink. They grumble at the lack of food and he gives them food. The issue isn't that they're having things that they legitimately need help from. They need help to be delivered from Pharaoh and his army. They need help to get water. They need help to have food. It's their posture as they start asking for the help. They're whining and grumbling and complaining about how hard things are in life. As I look at it, I see kind of two major problems I want to reflect on. We're going to keep going through this story. But two major problems that Israel faces from the very, very beginning of their freedom. They've gotten freedom from slavery, and yet all they can do is focus on the problems they have now. They have a problem of perspective. They're only focused on their present problems. They're focused on their danger. They're focused on their thirst. They're focused on their hunger. And it continues as you go through the story. They keep getting focused on just what's happening in that moment. And those are legitimate struggles. But it's one thing to recognize a legitimate struggle. It's another thing to be consumed by it. And they forget that there's a pillar of cloud and fire right in front of them that says, hey, I am God and I have led you here and I will take care of you. They forget what God has offered to them in the past. They're consumed by their present problems. It even leads them to misremember what life was like in Egypt for them when they had to make bricks with no straw and their children were being murdered. They look back and they actually, in Exodus 16, when they say, well, there we sat around pots of meat and we ate all the food we wanted as though they were like wealthy people back there. They're so consumed by their problems now that they forget the struggles that they had there. And the problem of perspective prevents them from seeing the presence of God around them. Exodus 17, actually, you get this story where they're complaining again about water. And so Moses hits a rock and the water comes out. Moses actually says, they were ready to stone me because they needed water so bad. They're so consumed by their problems. But Exodus 17:7, Moses calls the place Massah and Meribah because the Israelites quarreled and because they tested the Lord saying, is the Lord among us or not? He's done all of this stuff, and yet they find themselves so consumed by their struggles that they're sitting there saying, is God even here? Is God even with us? If I'm Moses, I'm like, do you see the cloud? Do you see the fire? Do you see the fact that we've crossed the Red Sea? Do you see the fact that you've had quail and manna every day to eat for however long they've been out there? They repeatedly forgot God's presence because they were so consumed by their struggle that was in front of them. Again, it doesn't mean it's not a legitimate struggle. But it's one thing to have a struggle. It's another thing to be consumed by it and lose all perspective on everything else that's happened. They had a problem of perspective. The second thing they had was a problem of expectation. They had this expectation that because they're going to be free from slavery, it means everything is going to be easy. Everything's going to be fine. We'll get out from Egypt and everything will be perfect, right? Well, no, you still have a journey. You still have a trip to take. It's not unlike a teenager who thinks if I can just leave home, then everything will be wonderful and perfect. Well, no, you still got a journey to take. The other example I thought of this week is I've heard lots of people complain about their bosses. You know, if I could just be the one in charge, or if I could just have my own business, then I wouldn't have all of this hassle of having to deal with this boss. And anybody who has been self-employed knows that you just get a whole different set of things that you need to work through. And anybody who's taken the management position where they become the boss just all of a sudden realizes, oh, I just have a whole bunch of other things I need to deal with. Just because you get freedom from one thing doesn't mean it's going to be easy in the next. Even when that thing you're getting freedom from for Israel is slavery. Truth is, they had expected more than what God had promised. Back in Exodus 6:8, God communicated to Moses what his promise was for his people. Exodus chapter 6, verse 8. Here's the promise that God had given to them. Said, I will bring you to a land I swore with uplifted hands to give you to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob. I will give it to you as a possession. I am the Lord. The promise is that God is going to take them from here, and eventually they are going to get to this place. Doesn't mean it's going to be easy. He never promises it's going to be without tension or conflict or struggle. He never promises any of that. But their expectation is something actually more than what God had promised. So they had a problem of perspective and they had a problem of expectation. I easily find myself in Israel's story. I so easily get overwhelmed by my struggles and my pains rather than remembering and giving thanks for God's continued presence and how He has brought me to where I am. I find myself, rather than torn, I start to read Israel's story and think, how could they be so stupid? And then I start thinking about how I sometimes walk through life, and then I start thinking, how can I be so stupid? Because it's so easy to get caught up in the same struggles, the problem of perspective and the problem of expectations. I want to suggest that of a couple of things that may help us as we walk through our journey. The first thing I want to encourage us to do is keep our expectations rooted in what God has actually promised. Keep our expectations rooted in what God has actually promised, not on what we wish God had promised. Because on our journey, we aren't promised that our freedom from slavery to sin into this new creation is going to be easy and wonderful and everything is going to be great. We are promised that the burden is going to be light. That means that the weight of expectation, that we have to measure up to certain standards, that we have to check all of these boxes in order for God to love us, that's not going to be there. But that doesn't mean that the journey through this world is going to be easy. What are we promised? We're promised that one day this world is going to be restored, that God is rescuing it and redeeming it, and we're promised that we, as we follow Jesus, have a chance to be a part of bringing that to bear now and to be a part of it when He fully redeems it. That's what we are promised. But we aren't promised that life's going to be easy in the interim. In fact, both Paul and Peter, talking to the New Testament church, actually both say that we should expect suffering. That it's going to be hard. Well, we get glimpses of it now, but what we're waiting for to come, it's going to be hard while we wait for it. We were promised, in Romans 8:28. We are promised that in all things God works for the good of those who love Him, who are called according to His purpose. We hold on to a promise like that. It's a great promise. But have you read around that promise? Because all around that promise is a section talking about our present sufferings and how all of creation is groaning, waiting for God's redemption. Just prior to that verse in Romans 8, it talks about how God's Spirit helps us in our weakness. That promise is not rooted. It's not saying everything's going to be easy. It's saying in this weakness, you can hold on because God's going to work this out for your good. He's going to take care of you, even through the struggling and even through the suffering. Just after that verse, it points to the good God has promised for us. When it says that we're going to be conformed to the image of His Son, and it works eventually getting to be how we're going to be glorified by God, a time when most theologians believe is going to come when God fully and finally restores the earth. It's a promise for us to hold on in the present, even though it's hard, even though we're struggling, with this expectation, this hope, this confidence that God's going to fulfill this in the future. It's meant to give us this something to hold on to when it's hard, not that everything's going to be easy. We need to keep our expectations rooted in what God has actually promised, not what I wish He promised. Another promise that I've heard many Christians hold on to, I've heard this, people have claimed this as their life verse hundreds of times. I've heard this. In Jeremiah 29:11, it says, "For I know the plans I have for you, declares the Lord, plans to prosper you and not to harm you, plans to give you a hope and a future." Anybody heard that verse before? Anybody read the context around that verse? Because that verse is written to exiles. It's written to people who have been taken out of the place that was their home, and they are in bondage in Babylon. To give you an idea of how hard their life was, Psalm 137 is a psalm that was written to express their struggles during that time. This is Psalm 137. This is how hard life was for people that was written to. Psalm 137 says, "By the rivers of Babylon we sat and wept when we remembered Zion. There on the poplars we hung our harps, for there our captors asked for songs. Our tormentors demanded songs of joy. They said, 'Sing us one of those songs of Zion. How can we sing the songs of the Lord while in a foreign land? If I forget you, Jerusalem, may my right hand forget its skill. May my tongue cling to the roof of my mouth if I do not remember you, if I do not consider Jerusalem my highest joy. Remember, Lord, what the Edomites did on the day Jerusalem fell. Tear it down, they cried. Tear it down to its foundation. Daughter Babylon, doomed to destruction, happy are those who repay you according to what you have done to us. Happy are those who seize your infants and dash them against the rocks.'" End of psalm. It's not a happy time for the people for whom Jeremiah 29:11 is written. That promise is written to them, and the verses around it tell them that they're going to actually live in this land for many years. And it was only going to be in the future, after most of the people who heard this promise had died, that Israel was going to be taken back to their home. I'm okay looking at that story and holding on to that promise that God has something for us, plans to prosper us, not to harm us, plans to give us a hope and a future, as long as we also understand that the context wasn't that everything was going to be happy and wonderful and just the way they wanted it. It was a promise that said, what you're experiencing now is not all there is. There's something bigger that God is doing, and God is at work, and He's got a hope, and He's got a future, and He's going to redeem all of this pain and all of the struggle and all of this mess, and He's going to make it better. So even when things feel like hell and they are falling apart, you can hold on to me and hold on to my promises. That's the promise that God gives us. Now, I'm thankful that we time and time again get glimpses of that now. Glimpses of God providing and God caring. In fact, even at Jeremiah 29 passages, He tells them, you know what? Get married. Settle down. Have kids. Raise a family. Seek the good of the place you're living. It's not that their life is going to be horrible and that nothing good is going to be there, but it's not going to be everything they wished it was. There's still going to be hard times. But in those hard times, God is still present, and He is going to bring things to His desired end, and it will be good for us. The way that Jesus has, from the very beginning, the way of Jesus has been an invitation to look beyond what seems obvious, to see a deeper reality and a hope at play. When you read through things like Jesus' Sermon on the Mount, it's not denying how things look. It's saying that God is doing something more than that, and we can hold on to that promise. It's saying, I know that it looks like the warmongers have the power, but there's a power and peace that's going to overcome that. I know that it looks like just pursuing wealth is the way to guarantee you're going to be well, but instead pursue generosity and I will provide what you need. The way of Jesus says, I know that it looks like everything is lost because your Savior is dead on a cross, but resurrection is coming and has already come. The way of Jesus says, I know it looks like all is lost as we struggle with the danger, as we struggle with the hunger and the thirst in the wilderness. But God is with you and He is going to provide you with what you need. The challenge for us is to keep our eyes on the expectations that God has actually promised for us, not to get confused by the expectations we want from Him. So that's the first thing I would suggest that we do as we walk through this wilderness that is our life, is keep our expectations rooted in what God has actually promised. When we read the story of the early church, and for the first 300 years of Christian history, Christians were getting killed over and over and over again. And the only thing that kept them going was the reality that this is not all there is in life. But there is something more to come that God has promised that we can participate in. And so the suffering of this life is worth it for participating in that. A second thing I want to encourage us to do. One is keep our eyes on the expectations God has actually promised. Two is watch for God at work in all kinds of unexpected places. Rather than keeping our focus on our struggles, on the pain, on all the negative things, what if we turned our eyes to not deny those things, but in the midst of those, start looking for where God might be at work. Where God might be giving His whispers and His encouragements, reminding you, saying, hey, I'm here. It's okay. You know, there's a couple of Sundays ago, I hadn't slept well for a few nights, and I left Sunday morning. During Sunday morning, I got some really hard updates, hard news from some people. It was really weighing me down, and I got home just exhausted. I was beat. And I get home, and I got an email from somebody who, out of the blue, something small would come up in a conversation. And it was just this little note of, hey, I just thought you might want to hear that this is what somebody said. And it was just the kind of encouragement that I absolutely, it was one of those things where on any other time, getting this little note would have been like, oh, that's nice. For me this day, because of where I was coming from, I started to cry. I was like, oh, I needed that gift of life and breath. And just that little email was just one of those things that God used to say, it's okay, I'm here. I got this. And I think we all have these things that if we're alert and paying attention, this little word or whisper or this provision that God gives saying, it's okay, I'm here. I wish we had a big pillar of cloud and fire. I wish we had that. We don't. But God is providing these little glimpses for us in all kinds of ways and places if we will watch for them and listen for them. And that brings me to the third encouragement. So the first one is keep our minds on the expectation that God has actually promised. Keep our expectation on what God has actually promised, not what we wish He'd promised. The second one is watch for God's provision in all kinds of unexpected ways and places. And the third thing is when we're in the midst of those struggles, spend some time rehearsing and reminding ourselves of God's provision and pursue His presence. Actually seek Him out. I remember there was a time when I was unemployed and I didn't know how or where I would ever contribute again. And God slowly but surely brought me back to a place of contribution. And so when I'm struggling now, I can look back at that and say, but remember, you remember then, God did that thing. And if I can hold on, that He's going to do something like that again. I can look back and remember a time when I didn't think I could take another step forward because of grief. But God has helped me to keep walking and even to walk alongside others as they grieve. But perhaps you can remember a time when you were so low in the throes of addiction that you didn't think there was any way out. But God helps you to find a way out and find people and friends to walk alongside you. And then even to help you gain a level of sobriety that's been able to have you help others on the journey. Or maybe you can remember a time when you didn't know how you were going to even pay the bills and keep the high girl on. But God provided through those neighbors or those friends or those people you didn't even know that brought a meal or brought a gift card or brought something so that you didn't need to buy groceries that night and you could pay the bill. Whatever it might be, rehearse those times when God has provided. Tell each other those stories. One of my favorite things in the whole story of the Exodus, when you get to the end and they're entering into the promised land, they cross over the Jordan River, and Joshua tells each tribe, hey, go get a stone and set these stones up. They call it an Ebenezer, but they stand the stones up. And what's the purpose of the stones? The purpose is partially to remember. The purpose, it says, is so that when you're walking here with your grandkids and they say, hey, what are those stones for? That you can tell this story over and over and over again about, because this is what God did for us. You can rehearse those stories and retell them so that those people who haven't gone through it can hear it and say, oh, so God is still doing stuff. He's done it for people I know, so I can lean into the hope and expectation that He can do this for me, too. We need to rehearse those times and stories of God's provision and pursue His presence. As we wrap up the sermon time, I want to invite us to pray a prayer together. This is a responsive prayer, and it's going to be on the screen. I'm going to read the first section, and you will respond with a common refrain every time. Can you read that up there? All right. So you'll read the all section as a response to this encouragement to trust that God is with us on this journey and that we can walk with Him. And sometimes we feel like we're walking through wilderness. Jesus, we choose to walk with You. When our spirits feel dry, help us to trust in Your Spirit. Jesus, we choose to walk with You. Fasting seems difficult. Prayers seem unanswered. Jesus, we choose to walk with You. The world howls like wild animals all around us. Jesus, we choose to walk with You. We can choose to worry or to trust You to provide. Jesus, we choose to walk with You. Temptation is everywhere. Doubts can overwhelm us. Jesus, we choose to walk with You. We know what it's like to walk through this desert, so You know what it's like to walk through this desert. Jesus, we choose to walk with You. You long to transform us with wilderness worship. Jesus, we choose to walk with You.